He's the rabbi of Kila Rea Mahuvim in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He's the director of 929 English, which is a web-based project that promotes the daily study of Tanakh, a fascinating project. And again, I encourage everyone to explore that as well. He is taught at City College and a number of other institutions. And again, you can listen to so much of his Torah, his Jewish history, on his website, and I cannot recommend it enough. I want to thank all of the various sponsors for enabling Rabbi Mintz to be here with us for these couple of days. The Biermans, the Blooms, the Friedmans, the Katzes, the Landaus, the Pickholtzes, and the Rosens. Again, all of the sponsorship information is on the flyer, but I specifically want to thank Josh Bierman, who I saw walk in, who was really the liaison and worked tirelessly to be the shadchan between BRS and Rabbi Mintz and to arrange all the sponsorships for this visit. So we are grateful, we are appreciative. Without further ado, please join me in welcoming Rabbi Mintz.
Do you need a sheet?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you, Rabbi Moskowitz. Thank you, everybody. Sorry, I'm going to speak loud. Thank you, everybody, for coming and for joining us this evening. It's a special treat for me to introduce such an amazing series on the history of the Orthodox rabbinate in America. I love the Orthodox rabbinate. I'm not sure about the Orthodox rabbinate of the 21st century, but definitely the Orthodox rabbinate of 100 years ago. Because who we are, what we are, and everything that we have is thanks to those rabbinic pioneers who had the amazing courage that these rabbis had in those early years when orthodoxy wasn't to be taken for granted, when Torah and mitzvos weren't to be taken for granted. What I want to do tonight is introduce the topic by talking a little bit about the very early Orthodox rabbinate in America. And you are very lucky over the course of the next months to have wonderful speakers speak about really the courageous leaders, the rabbinic leaders that American Jewry had over the 20th century. And when we talk about orthodoxy in America, we have to just talk about for a minute when the Jews came, when the Orthodox came, and why they came. In 1826, there were 6,000 Jews in America. That's not very many. In 1880, there were 250,000 Jews in America. Who were those 244,000 Jews who came in those, 50 years or so? Basically, they were German Jews. It was a difficult time in Germany. There was anti-Semitism, there were revolutions, and the Jews felt threatened. And therefore, many Jews thought they would have an opportunity here in the United States. But, and here is a very important but, German Jews in the 1800s tended, not all of them, but tended towards the Reform movement. So most of those Jews who came before 1880 tended to be Reform Jews. The most famous Reform temple in America, what's the most famous Reform temple in America? I knew that I have 12 different answers. In my mind, the answer I was going to give, whether it's right or wrong, is Temple Emmanuel on 5th Avenue and 65th Street. I don't know, the most important, the most prestigious, 3,000 seats, and the, celebrities and all of that. Temple Emmanuel, on 65th Street and 5th Avenue in Manhattan, was built during this period. And Stephen Wise, by the way, was one of the rabbis of Temple Emmanuel. So that answer was right also. He broke away and he went to the west side and created his own temple. But then, starting in 1881, with the assassination of the Tsar and the accusation that a Jew was involved in the assassination plot, Jews in Russia began to emigrate here to the United States. As I mentioned, on Shabbos between 1881 and 1924, 2.5 million Jews came here. But the difference between the Jews who came until 1880 and the Jews who came after 1880 is that the Jews who came after 1880 came from Russia, Poland, but mostly Russia. Most of those Jews came Orthodox, or at least were Orthodox when they lived in Russia. And therefore, when you want to talk about the beginning of Orthodoxy in America, that's the period, 1881 to 1924. And I know that there are many people here who trace their roots in the United States to those years, 1881 to 1924. In 1924, the United States, after the First World War, the United States closed the borders. That's its own fascinating story. It was that closing of the borders that made it so difficult for Jews in the 30s to get here. So the cutoff point is really 1924. And the Jews came here, as you all know the story, seeking the golden of Medina, seeking the, the streets that were lined with gold. What is that gold? Obviously, to everybody, that gold looked like something different. But the one thing that they all had in common was they wanted a life that was better than their life was in Russia. And many people found it, and many people didn't. But, and here's a very important but, for the first generation, the generation of immigrants, no different than immigrants to this country or any country, the first generation has limited options, right? They don't speak the language, they don't look the part, it's very hard for them to assimilate. So if it didn't work out for them, they didn't really have very many options. They just managed whatever managed meant. A push cart, a job somewhere. They needed a place to live. They needed a way to survive. And then came the second generation, the generation of Jews who were born here in the United States. The generation that was educated in the public schools, and again, as I said on Shabbos, they went to the public schools because there were no yeshivas, and because the public schools were free. Correct, that's all you need to say. Because the public schools were free. And they met people who were not Orthodox, who were not Jewish. And then when they graduated public school in New York City, where did they go to school?
Public college.
City college, they called it. What did they call City College? Right, the Harvard for the Jews, the Jewish Harvard, right? Okay, you understand that too. And of course, you know, the number of Nobel laureates, whatever the number is some ridiculously high number for City College. And of course, they're all Jewish and they come from that generation. And that's its own story. I'll have to come back another time and talk about the history of City College. But these Jews had opportunities. And we also know that until 1935, there was a six-day work week in New York City. In America, sorry. And therefore, if you didn't work on Shabbos, then you were looking for a new job on Monday. And the question that I want to look at tonight, and really the question that's going to frame Rabbi Moskowitz the whole series is, what did the Orthodox rabbinate in America do with an Orthodox base, with an Orthodox membership that weren't quite as Orthodox as they wanted them to be? To give one example, to kind of a, let's call it a teaser for something that's coming up, kind of a social answer. I'm going to talk more about religion, but kind of as a social answer, there was a synagogue, there was a shul in Harlem, on 124th Street. It was called the Institutional Synagogue. Some of you might be familiar with it. It moved to the West Side, so it gained two words in front of it. They call it now the West Side Institutional Synagogue, WSIS. People have different names for it. It's still there on 76th Street. But in the 1920s, they started a shul on 124th Street called the Institutional Synagogue. It was built by Harry Fischel. Harry Fischel was the most important, the first and most important Orthodox philanthropist in America. And lucky for his son-in-law, who happened to be a rabbi, he became the rabbi. His name, and one of the features of the series, Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. And he was a young Columbia College educated rabbi, and he became the rabbi of the institutional synagogue. And he went to shul on Shabbos morning and he delivered amazing sermons. He was eloquent and articulate and, you know, old-fashioned in the best sense of the term. There was only one problem. The institutional synagogue on Shabbos morning did not look like BRS on Shabbos morning. There was nobody there because they were in work. And of course, if the father goes to work, you know, goes to work, so the children have nobody to sit next to, and the wife doesn't want to come to shul, so there was nobody in shul. So he was delivering these amazing sermons to nobody. Now, the question is, what do? You're a great rabbi. You have amazing things to share, and you're speaking to nobody. So what are you going to do? So we'll see. One option is to schrei gewalt, to get up in shul on Shabbos morning and say, you're all sinners. You go to work on Shabbos, you're terrible, da-da-da-da-da-da. What's the problem with that? No, that they won't come back. They're not there, right? I mean, we say you're sinners and you go to work on Shabbos. They're at work on Shabbos. Who are you talking to? You're talking to the few people who can't get jobs and therefore they're in shul. So that's not going to get you very far. Now, that doesn't mean that most rabbis didn't do that. Of course, they didn't know what to do, the rabbis. So they schreied gewalt. But Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein was much smarter than that. What Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein said was, listen, of course I want the people to come to shul on Shabbos. Of course I want them not to work on Shabbos. But you know what? I mean, I know what I can do and I know what I can't do. I can't ask people to lose their jobs every week, so they're not going to come to shul on Shabbos. So what he started doing was an amazing thing. He started delivering his drasha on Friday night during davening. Friday night. In those days, it wasn't the New York of today. They didn't work all night. By 6 o'clock, they were home. They came to shul, and they heard Rabbi Goldstein deliver his drasha. Now, when Rabbi Goldstein delivered his drasha on Friday night, and he talked about how important Shabbos is, I don't know if they were not going to go to work the next day, but at least they heard it. And he was brilliant. Because you know what happened after davening on Friday night? He had a Kiddush, of course, because they didn't come to Kiddush on Shabbos morning. I don't know if they had Kiddush club in those days, but they had Kiddush, right? He had a big Kiddush after davening. So it was a social event, and everybody stayed, and everybody was friendly, and it was amazing. And I can't give you statistics. This is not the kind of thing where there are statistics to tell you how many people who davened in West Side Social Synagogue in the 20s and 30s therefore remained Orthodox or their children remained Orthodox. But I just want to show you the level of creativity. And I'm sure you'll hear about it when the rabbi speaks about Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. The level of creativity in these rabbis. What do rabbis do when their balabatim are not as orthodox as they want them to be? And basically they're not going to change that. That's the important point there. They're not going to change it because the factors that are causing these people not to be orthodox are greater than the factors that would keep them within orthodoxy. Specifically, the Americanism, the need to work. Now, what I want to talk about today is, I want to talk about an example of how the rabbis dealt with such a problem. But something that actually I can quantify a little better than the drush on Friday night and the kiddush after davening on Friday night. And that is, I want to tell you the story about the city of St. Louis. St. Louis? Well, let me tell you about St. Louis, and it'll be clear why I choose to tell you about St. Louis. The first Jew came to St. Louis in 1807. The first Minyan in 1837. These are just numbers, because there wasn't much in those days. But between 1880 and 1920, 50,000 Russian Jews, that means Orthodox Jews, moved to St. Louis. Help me out, everybody. Why St. Louis? Two words. Two words. No, railroad. Mississippi River. Mississippi River. Boats. Right? Meaning 1880, 1920. How did you do business in those days? I mean, the railroad, that's true that they did business through the railroad. But they did business. The Mississippi River was the most important point of commerce in the country. And St. Louis was in a very, very important city. So Jews who arrived in Ellis Island, some of them who could, moved on to St. Louis. 50,000 Jews. That's a real community. That deserves a discussion. And with 50,000 Jews, you're going to need some shuls. I want to tell you about two shuls that were both located on South 9th Street in downtown St. Louis. And I want to tell you about the two rabbis. They're familiar. Their names aren't familiar, but their story is familiar. The first rabbi's name was Rabbi Zachariah Rosenfeld. He was born in 1847 in Poland. And like a lot of these rabbis, he served at a few communities in Poland, but couldn't really make a living, ended up coming to America. Couldn't get a job in New York, of course not, because there were too many rabbis in New York. He got a job in Baltimore. But he was a yeshiva educated, he was a Talmud Chacham. And in 1895, he was invited by the Jewish community of St. Louis to come to St. Louis for one purpose, to build the mikveh. He moved to St. Louis, he built the mikveh. He died in 1915. His death was featured on the front page of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. That's pretty good for an Eastern European Rav who never spoke a word of English. The other rabbi was Rabbi Shalom Elchanan Jaffe. He was born in 1858 in Vilna, 10 years younger, but for our purposes the same. He studied, he learned in the Voloshina Yeshiva, and in his case, he came straight from Europe to St. Louis. Rabbi Jaffe, unlike Rabbi Rosenfeld, who was beloved, Rabbi Jaffe seemed to have been a little bit of a troublemaker. He was a rabbi in 1887 in St. Louis. By 1889, he seems to have been thrown out of St. Louis, goes back to New York. In 1891, he returns to St. Louis. By 1898, he's thrown out of St. Louis again, finds himself in Brooklyn, and is part of the leadership, the founders of the Agudas HaRabbanim. Now, as a troublemaker, you're not surprised to hear that he was the rabbi of the breakaway minyan from Rabbi Zachariah Rosenfeld Shul. The shul was called Sheiris Svard. I wish I had the story, but you don't need me to have the story. All those kinds of stories are more or less the same. Right? The shul broke away. They got their own rabbi. He was kind of a troublemaking rabbi. Rabbi Jaffe was perfect. But I'll tell you the thing that makes you wonder. The address of both the shul and the breakaway were South 9th Street in St. Louis. That's a problem. You don't want the shul and the breakaway to be on the same block. But that's the way it was in St. Louis in the early 1900s. Now the story I'm going to tell you is a little earlier than the story of Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein. The story of the Friday night drushes and the kiddush on Friday night, that took place in the 20s. This happened a little earlier. It's the same story, but it happened a little earlier. Seems to be that they in St. Louis, in the end of the 1800s, they were already dealing with Orthodox Jews who had become American, who weren't quite as Orthodox as they would have liked them to be. And they both felt, Rabbi Rosenfeld and Rabbi Jaffe, correctly so, that their job was to strengthen Orthodoxy and to strengthen Orthodox people in St. Louis. I mentioned that Rabbi Rosenfeld was invited to build the mikveh. The first book that Rabbi Jaffe wrote was an attack on the kashrus of the mikveh of Rabbi Rosenfeld. Okay, we're not going to talk about mikvos, though that also is an interesting topic. Seems to be that after he built the mikveh, and you understand, he was that type of rabbi who wanted to help the community. He built a mikveh. After you build a mikveh, what do you build? No, he had a shul already. What do you build? An eruv. A yeshiva. So, yeshiva, they don't have it yet. That's what I talked about on Shabbos. Yeshivas, they don't have till the 1930s. So, no. The answer is an eruv. Now, the eruv in St. Louis in 1896 is the first eruv in the history of the United States of America. Now, that's not surprising, because Orthodox Jews only lived here really since the 1880s. 1896, St. Louis, the first eruv. What's an eruv? So we know an eruv is the thing that allows you to carry on Shabbos. How exactly does an eruv work? One of the 39 prohibited activities on Shabbos is carrying in a public place. The rabbis already in the Mishnah, there's an entire Masechet, an entire tractate that discusses this, understood that there was a need to allow people to carry on Shabbos. Actually, the Eruv started because people used to live around courtyards. If you go to the old city in Yerushalayim, they still live around courtyards. People would live in apartments around courtyards, and everything they did was done in the courtyard in the middle. Remember Israel? It's hot. There's no air conditioning. So they ate in the courtyard and they hung out in the courtyard. And in the summer, they even slept in the courtyard. The problem is what? The problem is that the fourth side means that, you know, you enter on one side and there are houses on three sides. It wasn't enclosed, so it was a public property. So the rabbis in the Mishnah introduced the idea that if you enclose that area, even symbolically with a string, it's considered as if the area is enclosed, it's a private area, and therefore you are allowed to carry in that area. That was the introduction of the Eruv. But the Mishnah says that there's another issue when you build an Eruv. And that is the Eruv really unites the Jews that live in that area that's enclosed, whether it's a courtyard or it's the city of Boca Raton or it's the borough of Manhattan. It incorporates them in a way. The problem is that not everybody who lives in that area, in that enclosure, is Jewish. And if you want to create a Shabbos community, the Mishnah thinks that you have to create a Shabbos community of Jews to the exclusion of the non-Jews who live in that area. Therefore, says the Mishnah, you need to rent or lease the space, the apartment, the house of the non-Jew who lives within the Eruv community so that the entire community becomes a Shabbos Jewish community. That lease, says the Mishnah, just has to be symbolic. It can be for a dollar, and it can be for a dollar for 50 years. But it has to be. So therefore, if you lived around the courtyard, and there were three Jewish families living around the courtyard and one non-Jewish family, they would go to the non-Jew, they'd give him a dollar, and they would rent his house for a year, 50 years, and they would have an Eruv community. The Eruv around the courtyard became an Eruv around a neighborhood, became an Eruv around a city. And by the medieval period, the major cities in Germany and in France had Eruv. Now, in most of these communities, what that meant was, well, you see, in the medieval period, neighborhoods and or cities were surrounded by walls because that was protection. So the ability to enclose the area, that was pretty easy in many of these places. What did they do about the fact that non-Jews lived within the Eruv community? So actually, the Rishonim, the halachic rabbis in the medieval period said that you don't have to actually lease the space of every single non-Jew in the area individually. It's good enough to go to a representative of the community. We call him the mayor. And rent from the mayor the houses or the apartments of all the non-Jews who live in that area. And somehow, in each one of these situations, they established that kind of relationship and they were able to rent that area. Don't think that didn't come with complications. In the 1500s, the Jewish community of Constantinople, today we call that Istanbul, wanted to build an Eruv. And they went to the representative of the Sultan, the king of Turkey, and they asked to rent the space. Right? Like, what's the big deal? Here's a dollar, we'll rent your space. We have a document in which the Sultan writes to his assistants and says, what are the Jews trying to do? They're trying to take over this country. So you see, it wasn't so simple all the time. But Eruvin were built in the medieval period. In the early modern period, Amsterdam had an Eruv. Amsterdam around canals, it was easy. The canal walls created the Eruv walls. And then, as the Jews moved to Eastern Europe, all of the cities, first of all the Western European cities, Frankfurt had an Eruv, Warsaw had an Eruv. Actually, in 1938, we have a tshuva that they wanted to build an Eruv in Paris. Unfortunately, the war came, but we have actually a documentation about the ability to build the Eruv in Paris. And all the shtetlach had Eruvin. There's an old tradition that Hasidim like Eruvin and Litvaks don't like Eruvin. That may or may not be true, but I want to tell you that there was an Eruv around the city of Brisk. Meaning, even the Lithuanian cities had Eruvin. Why is that important? That's important because these two rabbis, Rabbi Rosenfeld and Rabbi Jaffe, they came from places in Europe where there were Eruvin. And therefore, when they came to the United States, when they came to St. Louis, if they wanted to recreate the orthodoxy of their past, the mikveh was a piece of it, and the Eruv was a piece of it. And Rabbi Rosenfeld decided that he needed to build an Eruv. Now, what's the problem? Well, you know, I'm not sure how much you guys know, everybody knows about building an Eruv today. Most of the Eruv is based on poles and strings, some of them that are erected already, some of them that are put up. But each one of those poles and each one of those strings needs permission from somebody, from the local authorities. That's just the way it works. Now, Rabbi Rosenfeld was not in any position to ask anybody for permission. The Jews in 1896 did not feel comfortable in America. They didn't feel comfortable to approach the mayor. They didn't feel comfortable to approach anybody. And therefore, that was out of the question. So if Rabbi Rosenfeld was going to create an Eruv in St. Louis, it was going to be an Eruv in which the enclosures, the boundaries of the Eruv, were natural boundaries, not boundaries that he was going to sit with a hammer and knock in. And therefore, on two sides, he describes, there were rivers. And those rivers, or specifically the river banks, create Eruv walls. On a third side, it was the railroad tracks. And on the fourth side, it was a wall that was guarding a cemetery. Now, you could imagine and if I had a big screen, I would show you a picture, a map of St. Louis, that these Eruv boundaries were far beyond the Jewish community. Miles and miles beyond the Jewish community. Basically, Rabbi Rosenfeld traveled and traveled and traveled until he found a wall, until he found a river, because he did the best that he could do. There weren't many walls, there weren't many rivers on South 9th Street in downtown St. Louis. But that's only half his problem. What's he going to do about leasing the space of all the non-Jews who live in St. Louis? So Rabbi Rosenfeld writes that he decided to lease the space from the local policeman. You can imagine, right? He probably gave him a dollar and a bottle of schnapps and says, listen, I need you to just take this dollar and let's call it a day. He didn't speak English. The policeman probably didn't understand him at all, for sure didn't. And they kind of shook hands on it. He writes in his book, Rabbi Rosenfeld, that it was halachically acceptable to lease the space from the policeman because the police have the right to enter anybody's house that they want to. Now, whether that's exactly true and whether that's halachically acceptable, that's an interesting conversation for another time. The point is, and that's the most important point, the point is he had no choice. He wasn't going to approach the mayor. I mean, the mayor would have laughed him out. He didn't speak any English. He was an old Eastern European rub. He couldn't go to the mayor. He couldn't go to the city council. He did the best that he could do. He wanted to build an Eruv, and therefore he created this situation where he rented the space from the policeman. Okay, the Eruv is built. In comes Rabbi Jaffe. Rabbi Jaffe writes a book called Shoel Ka'inyan. We call it a book. It's not really a book. It's a little pamphlet. In those days, they used to publish little pamphlets. And in his pamphlet, he spends page after page after page explaining how every single thing that Rabbi Rosenfeld did was halakhically wrong. That each one of the four boundaries of the Eruv was not an acceptable boundary. The river wasn't a river, and the railroad track wasn't a railroad track, and the wall around the cemetery wasn't really a wall around the cemetery. And of course, the police chief, or the policeman, didn't really have the right to enter anybody's house. Basically, he says, all the police chief has the right to do is to direct traffic. And he says that the Eruv that Rabbi Rosenfeld built is halachically unacceptable. Now that's interesting. And we could have an interesting year-long course studying the arguments and trying to figure out who's right and who's wrong. Is the Eruv halachically acceptable? Is it not? But what I want to share with you tonight, what I want to study with you tonight, are short excerpts of the introductions that were written by each one of these rabbis, explaining by Rabbi Rosenfeld why he created the Eruv, and explaining by Rabbi Jaffe why he opposed the Eruv. I gave it to you in the original Hebrew because it's so amazing to read what they write and how they write it. I'll read it slowly. It's so beautiful. Let's start with Rabbi Rosenfeld. Tikvas Zechariah. Be'ezras Hashem Yisparach. On the bottom of the first page, in the underline, Hine Basi, I'll read it in Ashkenazis because that's the way he would have read it. Hine Basi El Hamedina Hazos. I came to this country. Ra'o ra'isi gamak sherim ba'am, even the most religious of the people, mehem rabbi matirim la'atzmam l'taltel b'shabbos, even the most religious people allowed themselves to carry on Shabbos. Ha'ish ha'yisraeli asher kol davar kodesh yikadesh, a nice Jewish man who basically observed all the laws, Hu lo yevosh, he will not be embarrassed. Latzeis v'lavo l'taltel b'farhesya, to go and to come and to carry publicly, es hatalis l'satev bo b'eis hatfila. You have men who are walking through the street with their talesim on Shabbos morning. Amarti ani el libi, I said to myself, says Rabbi Rosenfeld, Ma e'eseh, what should I do? L'tovas b'nei ami, for the good of my people. L'hasir mehemes achata'a ha'gedola hazos, to remove from them this terrible sin of carrying on Shabbos. And now, and this is what's so beautiful, he goes through the options. What am I going to do? They're carrying on Shabbos. What should I do? Im kashofar arim koli. What does that mean? If I raise my voice like the shofar. Lahabia bekalam lavinam eschomer isur. I said before, I'll shry gavalt in a loud voice about how terrible it is to carry on Shabbos. Yadati gam yadati, I know so well. Divarai lo yakushoresh velo yasuperi. My words will accomplish absolutely nothing. Kichvar avru shanu v'shilshu v'shileshu v'hutolahem. Because they've been doing this every Shabbos. They don't care what I say. And now he says, and in case you don't believe me, v'gam hamagidim harabim asher loku lehem karnayim b'medina hazos. And all the Megidim, all the rabbis who give drushes in this country, Kvar Hirgilu Esam, the people are already used to this kind of stuff. People who, rabbis who shry gavalt about what they're doing wrong. Liosam Potskim Peh V'lashon V'nivsiv Sosehem, that they just talk and talk and talk. This is the best part. Yitzpichu B'raglehem, they bang their feet. Yispiku bekafot yedeyem. What does that mean? They clap. Umikaf regel v'adrosh yimadu bechol evarehem. They shake and shake. Lehit vakeach bepirut maaseihem. To complain about the way the people are acting. I mean, can you imagine that graphic? That's an amazing optics, right? Amnam. However, lo samu lahem machsom, but no one has stopped them. Miladaber dvarim she'inam nishma'im. No one has stopped them from saying things that are not listened to. And the people don't even bother listening anymore. Even if I get angry and angrier, and I make fun of the people who carry on Shabbos, kvar noda, we all know the rule. Shaharagzan lo olsabiyado ella ragzinuso, that the guy who gets angry, all he has to show for his anger is what? His anger, right? Accomplishes nothing. So therefore, option number one is to what? Option number one is to scream. Is he going to accomplish anything if he screams? Zero. Vilazo samarti. And therefore I say, Afaresh biderech tzachut ma'amar ne'im zmirot Yisrael. I will follow the words of David HaMelech in Tehillim. Chishavti derachai, I thought about my ways. V'yashiva raglai el edosecha, and I will return my feet to your words. Ki kasher chashavti derachai, chishavti derachai, Ve'ein tikva, when there's no hope, azashiva raglaya ledosecha, ulayim tza makom limtzo derech heter al pi hatorah hakidosha. To scream and to yell will get me nowhere. Therefore, I might as well do what? Try to find a way which allows people to carry on Shabbos. I mean, when you read this, it's amazing. 1896. This is what he says. It could be written 2019. Maybe. I don't know if we write this way anymore, but we appreciate it today. He says, people are doing the wrong thing. I can scream and scream and scream and scream, but they're not going to listen. So therefore, I might as well do what? I might as well figure out a way to make what they're doing kosher. Make what they're doing allowed. Wow. What does Rabbi Jaffe think about that? Everybody, what do you think? What does Rabbi Jaffe think about that? Why not? Tell me, before I read it, what does Rabbi Jaffe think about that? The kind of, you know, I want to tell you something. That sounds nice to me. I like that. No one's going to listen when I tell them not to do it, so I'm going to find a way to allow it. I like that. Why? What's Rabbi Jaffe going to say? Why not? Not halachically kosher. So, the next page, and I apologize, this is genuine, this is authentic. This is what the page looked like. I couldn't get it any lighter than this. Ki ma yihye keitz hayahadut bepoiri. What's going to be the future of Judaism here in my city? V'amarti, and I said, Asah koliel heharim. I'm going to look to the mountains. Hema avoseinu hagaonim avoseyem shel Yisrael asher baret hema. I could ask all the rabbis to say, what's going to be the future of Judaism in my city in St. Louis? So I'm going to send a letter to all the rabbis in Eastern Europe, and I'll ask them what to do about St. Louis. What's that going to get them? No. Not very much. V'gam el kol gaonei ugedolei Yisrael hayoshvim al medin. V'yeye k'talmid hadan lifnei rabosav. V'heima yakumu v'yoshienu. I could ask all the rabbis to save me, but that's not going to help me very much. And now he tells the story. V'zehu tochen hamase. Hineze mikarov balipo St. Louis. He says, recently, a rabbi has come here to St. Louis. V'hitir bipo hahotza'a b'shabbat. And he is allowed here carrying on Shabbos. Al yedei heterim biduyim milibo she'ein lahem af yesod re'uah. He says he allowed carrying, and he doesn't even have what? He doesn't even have any shaky basis for his explanation. And he kind of tried to build an argument. Binyan kikore achbish. It's like a spider's web. V'amar, and he said, Shebe'emet mutar l'taltel b'chol arei America. You see, here's a little trick. What he claims is that Rabbi Rosenfeld doesn't only allow for carrying in St. Louis. Rabbi Rosenfeld actually allows for carrying where? All over in every city in America. V'hamit partzim rabu ka'et bidor hazeh umagam ba'America. And those people who break the rules, they're everywhere. Especially in America. Shemakalam yagid lahem, kol hamekil lahem biyoter, ochazim bichnaf milo. And they look for the rabbi who's the most lenient, and they grab on to his coattails. It's fantastic. Ve'omrim shekoach teheteira adif lahem. And they're looking for people who say that it's all allowed. Uvacher hadavar halazeh yuchal liot le'even nigaf l'chol arei America. And he says, what's going on in St. Louis is not only a problem in St. Louis, it could turn out to be a problem
all over America.
Ki mi liyadenu yitzka im lo yimtzu od b'nei gilo sheyilmedu l'shaker lehatir lahamon lahamon am mashi yirtzu kidei limtzochein b'neihem. Because what's going to stop other rabbis from saying absolutely anything so they can gain favor in the eyes of their congregants? V'kasher mitpa'arim gam heim. And when they claim good things for themselves, shehu yaseh lahem gam heter lechanuyotehem la'amod biyom ha-shabbat al yedei sheyizkeru l'mishartehem. He says, and you know what? If we allow the Eruv in St. Louis, you know what's next? People are going to leave their stores open on Shabbos by saying that they're selling the store to the workers for Shabbos. What exactly is Rabbi Jaffe doing here? He's actually doing something, two things that he's doing. Number one is, as a way of exaggeration, as a way of kind of arguing how terrible what Rabbi Rosenfeld is doing, he exaggerates the extent of the discussion about the Eruv in St. Louis. It's no longer a discussion about the Eruv in St. Louis. If we allow the Eruv in St. Louis, what's going to happen? Orthodoxy is going to be done in America. And it seems to be that the idea of keeping the stores open on Shabbos was obviously something that was a big issue in 1896. People wanted their stores open on Shabbos. So he connects it to something that people were familiar with. If we allow the Eruv, then the next thing you know, we won't have orthodoxy. The men will be working on Shabbos. Now, what do we have here? First of all, we have two presentations by two rabbis in St. Louis that are extremely passionate about what they believe in. That's the first thing you should know. It's not like one of them is passionate and one of them is like, you know, what's the big deal? You want an Eruv, you don't want an Eruv. They're equally passionate. What are they arguing about? Rabbi Rosenfeld argues that the role of the Orthodox rabbi in America is to be accommodating. What does that mean, to be accommodating? To use the halacha to accommodate the needs of Orthodox Jews in America. And if that's the way you deal with Orthodox Jews who aren't quite as Orthodox as we'd like them to be, we need to accommodate their needs. Rabbi Jaffe understands that. And Rabbi Jaffe says that if that's the attitude we take, if we take the attitude of accommodation, you know what we're going to be left with? Zero. And therefore, Rabbi Jaffe says what we need to do is, we need to defend the principle. The principle is what? Shabbos. You tell me they're carrying their talesim to shul on Shabbos? I'm sorry. But if I figure out a way to allow them to carry their talesim, what's going to happen to the principle? Shabbos will be forgotten. People will work on Shabbos. They won't take Shabbos seriously anymore. Is the role of the Orthodox rabbi when dealing with the non-Orthodox as they would like Jew to accommodate their needs? Or to say, I cannot accommodate your needs. For the sake of Yiddishkeit, for the sake of the future, I need to stand up for the principle. What an argument. So who's right? Well, let me tell you that the Eruv was accepted in St. Louis. Of course, it didn't have very much to do with this. It had to do with the fact that Rabbi Rosenfeld was a beloved rabbi in St. Louis. Everybody loved him. And therefore, they followed what he said. Rabbi Jaffe was a troublemaker. Before you knew it, he was gone, and therefore forgotten about. But that's a detail about St. Louis. My role here tonight is to introduce a series about the history of the American Orthodox rabbinate. And the history of the American Orthodox rabbinate is the history of rabbis who struggled between the need to accommodate and the need to stand by the principle. Now, some of that has to do with personality. Some people are accommodators. Some people are stand by the principle kind of guys. Of course. But the question is, what is the best approach to save Orthodoxy in America? And some of the rabbis you're going to hear about over the course of this semester are going to be accommodators. And some of the rabbis are going to be stand by the principles. And some of them are going to be dealing with it within themselves on this very issue, struggling within themselves about whether to accommodate or whether to stand by the principle. But I just want to conclude by pointing out, you know, sometimes when things are like, you know, very clear, there are two roads, accommodator or stand by the principle. It's too clean. It's too easy. I want to tell you that it wasn't just about whether these rabbis would accommodate the needs of the people or whether they would stand by the principle. They understood, each one of these rabbis understood, that each one of those options carried with it tremendous risk. And let me explain. You know, you stand by the principle. The problem when you stand by the principle is that sometimes who gets hurt and who gets lost? The person, the individual. Rabbi Soloveitchik, many decades later, in 1965, delivered a famous speech at the Rabbinical Council of America convention. In that speech, he talked about a young couple that came to him. And the young couple was about to get married. And they told the Rav the following story. They said that before the wedding, they went to the cemetery. The nice chassan and his wife, who was a convert to Judaism. And they came to the cemetery and they saw on the grave of the chassan's father this sign. And they realized that the chassan was a kohen. They weren't Orthodox, they weren't connected. She had converted Orthodox and they were ready to get married and spend their whole life together. Rabbi Soloveitchik said in 1965, he said, "You think that it didn't hurt me that I was breaking up this couple? You think that it didn't break my heart to see this young couple in front of me and to know that they couldn't get married? But what could I do? The Torah says that a Kohen can't marry a convert." You stand by the principle. And Rabbi Soloveitchik stood by the principle. But he understood and he shared with those rabbis in 1965 the fact that there's pain in standing for the principle sometimes. And you have to understand and appreciate that personal pain. And accommodation, while it sounds so wonderful, also carries with it a certain risk. Of course, we know that the conservative movement decided that they would accommodate the needs of their community. And therefore, in the 1950s, when the Jews were moving to the suburbs and it was too far to walk to shul, they gradually allowed for driving to shul on Shabbos. They were accommodating. They needed to fill the shuls. They knew that if these people didn't come to shul on Shabbos, they'd have no Judaism. Their intentions were good. They accommodated. But what happened ultimately was kind of a breakdown of the conservative movement and the conservative community. Because there's a risk in accommodation. There's a halakhic risk that you're compromising the halakha, and there's a social risk that when you start accommodating, there's nothing left anymore. And therefore, the history of the American Orthodox rabbinate is the accommodator and the one who stands for the principle. But it's the rabbi who understands that as important as accommodation is, it comes with the risk of giving up everything. And it's the understanding of the rabbi who wants to stand for principle, who understands that there's hurt and pain sometimes in standing for principle. And it's the rabbi who can appreciate that pain, and the rabbi who can appreciate that tension, who ultimately became the leader and allowed us to be as we are today. Thank God today we don't have these challenges in the same way. We don't have the need, we can live our Orthodox Torah lifestyle without the need to accommodate the way that Rabbi Rosenfeld needed to accommodate in 1896. Thank God we can carry in Boca Raton or on the Upper West Side of Manhattan with an Eruv that is accepted by everybody. Because thank God we have relationships that allow us to put up the poles and the strings, and mayors, even the mayor of New York City, who embraces us and gives us a document where we want to rent the entire borough of Manhattan. Because that's because we're lucky as Orthodox Jews today. And thank God we can stand by the principles today of Torah and Yiddishkeit, but at the same time embrace those who feel the pain and allow them to remain within the community. But we only have that luxury and we only have that ability because of the great rabbinic leadership that came before us. I'm jealous of all of you, because you're going to be able to hear this year about some of the great rabbinic leaders throughout the past century or century and a quarter. Enjoy the journey. It's an amazing one. Thank you very, very much.
In 1991,
I remember it very well.
Right, Faye and Maria Eisenberg.
I do.
Young couple. We're in the smoke fish business.